Blog Talk Radio.
And tonight, our favorite show is Glow, brought to you by the good people at Netflix and the same folks who gave us Orange is the New Black and Weeds. I am your host, the mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Radulich. And joining me as we review all 10 episodes of Glow tonight is fellow wrestling aficionado in his own right, and fan of the good people who brought us Orange is the New Black and Weeds, Mr. Sean Comer. How do you do, sir?
Hi, everybody. I'm Sean. You're not, and I like beer.
Sean, did you watch the original Glow when it was on syndicated television back in the old days? The days of yore?
Oh, God almighty. You know what? As much as I'm a wrestling fan, and as much as I've made a point of going back and watching as much older stuff as I have, Glow was just way, way kind of before my time. I started watching wrestling with WrestleMania 7 to kind of date myself a little bit. But by that time, Glow was really by and large a thing of the past. I started off as a WWE guy, and then I found WCW in syndication. When I was growing up back in Minnesota, we had a syndicated two-hour block with host segments every Saturday night called Saturday Night Ringside, hosted by an AWA alum named Slick Mick Karch. It was, I believe, the first hour was WCW Worldwide, and then the second hour was, I want to say it was USWA, or it might have been Global, because I think at some point two merged, which, you know, that promotion was the very first place where I saw a very, very young Sean Waltman applying his trade for the first time. But unlike some friends of mine, I didn't really grow up with classic NWA. I didn't get to see any of the regional territories except for the odd rerun of the AWA here and there because, again, like I said, you know, grew up the first 12 years of my life in Minnesota, the AWA's backyard. So I can't really speak to how authentic this was to the actual atmosphere of Glow, but it has to do with wrestling, and so that's always going to get me to at least give something a cursory look.
Well, I was a big fan of Glow. I was a big fan of anything wrestling. I grew up in New York, and I probably started watching wrestling around 1985, and like I remember the old WrestleMania commercials. I also remember going to the video store, being able to rent a lot of the WWF Coliseum videos. I certainly remember the video, I Like to Hurt People, which I never saw, but I always thought that was a great title for a wrestling video.
Yep. I watched that one many times.
But I definitely tuned into Glow when that was on. And at whatever age I was when I saw it, it was a little too cheesy for me, but I and like even then I had an eye for production, you know, and WWF played to large audiences and arenas, and it always looked, WWF in my mind, my child mind, looked authentic. And I remember watching like WCW Saturday Night when they shot that at Hollywood Studios, MGM Studios back in the day, you know, the old Disney lot, and GLOW, which I think was also shot in like was shot on like a soundstage somewhere, or you know, in a Vegas room somewhere. And I remember thinking, this looks like crap, but there was something about Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling that despite it looking terrible, captured my attention. It might have been the girls by the, you know, in and of themselves, little horn dog that I was. It might have been the fact that it was wrestling. Either way, I really started to, over time, despite its cheesiness, fall in love with the product. And to this day, Pat Mullen, friend of the show, is sending us some notes. GLOW was shot in a modified studio in a hotel lobby. Thank you, Pat. It certainly looked that way.
Thanks, Pat.
I remember my favorite character from that show apparently shows up in season 3 and 4, and it was Big Bad Mama. There was nothing like a large black woman with her face painted a la Roddy Piper to really get me going. That was, it doesn't get better than Big Bad Mama. Tells you a lot about how I grew up as a kid. But, you know, GLOW had its time, and you know, and it certainly had its place in wrestling lore. Jim Cornette apparently hates it, but Jesus Christ, Jim Cornette hates everything. So what are you going to do?
Occasionally I agree with, well, in fact, no, a lot of times, let's be honest, I agree with Jim, but occasionally he just develops an irrational, often hypocritical hatred of something that even after you hear him out, you still kind of have to go, no, your reasons for hating this are still stupid. And,
yeah.
I mean, first off, for those of you who are not wrestling fans, a little bit of a reality check about something. Women's wrestlers in the 80s, just in case there's any doubt, no, they were not remotely as easy on the eyes as Debbie Gilpin and Allison Brie. Betty Gilpin, I'm sorry. Transpose that with the name of her character. They were not nearly as great looking as Allison Brie or Betty Gilpin. Oh, no. No. They did not look remotely as athletic as a lot of the women you see around the business today. It was, I mean, they, granted, they weren't all the fabulous moolah in terms of looking, you know, kind of dumpy and kind of like they could hold their own in a dockside brawl. But I would also go as far as to say as the athleticism wasn't quite what you see displayed here sometime. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even say there were that many that were quite like Cherry Junk Chain Bang, the kind of displaced stunt woman played by Sydell Noel. This really takes some creative liberties with what the nature of professional wrestling was in the 80s. So I can kind of see if Cornette was maybe a little pissed at it about that, but as far as how he felt about the actual profession, look, everything had to start someplace. Okay.
Well, last thing, I don't want to get off too much on a tangent, but his recent comments were basically he hated the original GLOW product. He hasn't seen the television show.
Okay, why? Why did he hate the original GLOW?
You know, for the same reason he hates everything. And I'm not saying that
explanation. That's a poor explanation. Why did he actually hate it?
Okay, so Jim Cornette's whole thing is wrestling should look like wrestling. There shouldn't look like there is cooperation. It shouldn't look like a tumbling display. It should look like a fight. And
yeah,
admittedly, the wrestling in GLOW was not great. So I think that's what he's judging it on. It looked like obvious cooperation in his eyes.
Well, but then again, that was also at a time when there weren't really that many women, period, around the wrestling landscape. So no, of course it was going to be kind of limited. It really was about like what Machu Picchu's father says of it at one point. He basically referred to women as more or less a sideshow attraction. He likened them to midgets. So of course it wasn't taken that serious, and of course there weren't that many women who were around to kind of give it the kind of investment in athleticism and ambitious storytelling that you see from the likes of Becky Lynch and Sasha Banks and Charlotte Flair and Bayley, Nia Jax, Alexa Bliss, Mickie James, et cetera, anybody else you can name from the current WWE roster. Or in the case of NXT, the likes of, you know, Asuka. But I would love to know what Jim would have kind of expected from a promotion like that in that place and time.
Well, have I got a treat for you, Sean, and after this we should actually start talking about the show itself. We actually have Jim Cornette on the line. Jim, can you give us a little insight as to what your issues with GLOW were? Go ahead, Jim Cornette.
Oh God! Well, what the fuck? There was that 2 year period where they fucking syndicated on every goddamn channel. You couldn't get the fuck away from GLOW, and they'd fucking march these girls out in their one piece fucking bathing suits and expose the whole goddamn business with the fucking hokey shit they were doing. And David McLean, who worked for fucking Bruiser as a boy photographer in Indianapolis, like I did in Memphis for Christine Jarrett, would come out and pull these fucking girls off the street and send them to Mondo Guerrero to train them and fucking bump around like shit. Everything they did looked fucking terrible. My God, it was such an exposure of the fucking business.
Wow, that's, as Jim Cornette impressions go, that's at the very least a solid 8.5 out of 10.
Yep. You know what's funny about that is my wife just came over to me and tapped me on the shoulder. She's like, "Did Jim Cornette really call you?" I'm like, "No." All right.
Kudos. I raise my Guinness Antwerpen to you, wondrous Jim Cornette impersonator. And that was about the appropriate amount of fucks that you hear in a standard angry rant. I almost want to play a game of word association and rattle off Kenny Omega or Joey Ryan and just see how many you can squeeze into a 60-second span.
All right, so June 23rd, Netflix dropped this new show, 10 episodes of GLOW. And GLOW is a fictionalized retelling of what happened with the actual show. A lot of the characters are amalgamations or approximations of characters that were in the actual GLOW. There was no actual Zoya the Destroyer, but there was a Russian character. For example, there was a Russian character that was from that was actually in GLOW. That was called Colonel Ninotchka. I had to pull it up real quick. Same thing with Debbie Egan, the character in the show played by Betty Gilpin. She's Liberty Bell, but that's actually based on the GLOW wrestler, GLOW wrestlers, Americana, Americana, Scarlett and Tara, the Southern Belle. So, and it just goes on like that. We'll go ahead and get into really quick, Sean, really, really quick. Tell me, when you heard that they were doing a GLOW television show, What were your thoughts? Were you excited about it? Were you a little eager? Because sometimes, you know, when they do stuff with wrestling in Hollywood, it doesn't turn out so good. It turns out to be more making fun of it than anything else. So what were some of your thoughts about a possible GLOW TV show on Netflix?
Oh, mano, Aldo Montoya, the Portuguese Man-O-War. You really kind of nailed it with the part about really being skeptical, because occasionally Hollywood, be it television or movies, gives you a depiction of wrestling that really nails it spot on in terms of being both entertaining and pretty true to the nature of the business. You know, not everything exactly has to be the wrestler, but one of the reasons why the wrestler stuck out so much when it hit theaters and made such a big impact was because, number one, it wasn't just a great wrestling movie, it was a great fucking movie overall, but it's also the fact that up to that point, almost anything that had been made where professional wrestling was the backdrop was more akin to No Holds Barred, which is a classic of riff-worthy, so bad it's good movie making. So I was encouraged by the fact that Jenji Cohen was behind it, because I've enjoyed her previous two hit shows, although I was somewhat concerned, and as it turns out, kind of rightfully so, that it was going to have the same trappings as Weeds and Orange Is the New Black do. When I finally saw it, I was pleasantly surprised at the length they went to bring actual professional wrestlers on board and to perhaps, yeah, fictionalize the actual nature of the actual genesis of GLOW, but also the fact that they clearly put some time into thinking about, you know, the nature of wrestling in the 80s and really treating it somewhat affectionately. And hats off, to be honest with you, for the fact that you have a number of wrestlers who are there in supporting or cameo roles, such as John Morrison, Brodus Clay, Carlito, Joey Ryan, his real life and fellow wrestler Laura James, Alex Riley, Christopher Daniels, Frankie Kazarian. You even have Kia Stevens, one of my favorite female wrestlers of all time, Awesome Kong, in a regular role as Tammy the Welfare Queen Dawson. And oh God, does she om nom 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 that scenery pretty much every second she's on screen. Took me a second to recognize her, actually. When I very first saw her, I briefly mistook her for Retta from Parks and Rec. I would say it exceeded my expectations, enough so that I hope it gets a second season, and I will wholeheartedly watch it if it does. But at the same time, as we'll get into as we go along, yeah, folks, it's a Jenji Cohen show, all right, for better and for worse.
Yeah, I didn't even recognize that was Awesome Kong at first, and part of the reason I didn't recognize it was Awesome Kong was because she does a phenomenal job actually acting. You know, there's a scene where she has some lamentations, some reservations about being the welfare queen because she's got to deal with her. She actually has kids, you know, and people are going to see this. And it's funny. This goes to something I thought about as you were talking and even as I watched the show. I really thought that this was a love letter to wrestling. I thought it treated wrestling with the appropriate amount of respect. You know, people really do enjoy this and become invested in it, and it's not something that necessarily should be made fun of, you know, in the sense of, oh, people who watch wrestling are dumb and wrestling itself is dumb. Mm-hmm. It's a thing. It exists like anything else, and people enjoy it. And so just treat it with that amount of respect, I think, is all anyone ever really asks. But one of the things that comes up among wrestlers is that oftentimes people can't differentiate the person from the gimmick. I remember, you know, like someone referring to Ric Flair. Ric Flair walks around as Ric Flair all the time. When is Ric Flair not Ric Flair? And I think that's a real concern, especially when you take on the role of something as negative as Welfare Queen, you know, such an awful stereotype. Yeah, it's great when you're performing, but if that's all anyone ever sees you as, that's horrifying. And it was a real concern of hers. And I thought she did an excellent job of portraying, no pun intended, wrestling with her persona versus how she's supposed to operate in real life. Once again, to the point that I didn't realize it was Awesome Kong. Someone pointed it out to me. So good on her for that. I'm just going to do a brief summary of the entire show here. It focuses on our two main characters, Allison Brie, who plays Ruth Whiter, otherwise known as eventually as Zoya the Destroyer, and Betty Gilpin as Debbie Liberty Bell Egan. They are friends who become enemies once Betty finds out that Allison has cheated with her husband, Betty's husband. The show revolves around the creation of this gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling TV show that is produced by a fellow named Bash and is directed by Mark Maron's character, Sam Sylvia. Over the course of 10 episodes, we get the introduction of all the girls, the giving out of gimmicks. There's some conflicts among the girls here and there to sort of drive the story. And then eventually they build towards them losing their funding. And then it's about, well, we've already created this thing that we believe in. We want to see it succeed. And so how are we going to get the show made and get, you know, and get it on the air like we wanted to when we've now run out of money. So there's those storylines that get wrapped up, and eventually we get to the show itself, where, you know, it's as good as anything the WWF's put out in the last couple of years. We've got swerves aplenty. We've got some real great characters. Everything sort of comes together and they put on a successful show. As far as, Ruth and Debbie, as Debbie says, they can work together, but they're not friends yet. They've got a ways to go before she softens up. Along the way, as you said, we meet Jackie Tone as Melanie Melrose Rosen, Kate Nash as Rhonda Britannica Richardson, Britt Baron as Justine Scab Yagi, Chris Lowell as the aforementioned Bash, as Sean mentioned, Sydell Noel as Cherry Junk Chain Bang, Brittany Young as Carmen Machu Picchu Wade, who's supposed to basically be Mount Fiji, Rich Summers as Mark Egan, Kami Gatewood as one of the fighting biddies, Rebecca Johnson as the other fighting biddy. Sunita Mani as Beirut the Mad Bomber, the aforementioned Awesome Kongs, Kia Stevens as the Welfare Queen, Gail Rankin as Sheila the She-Wolf, Ellen Wong as Jenny Fortune Cookie Che, Marianne as Reggie as Vicky the Viking Walsh, and finally we have Alex Rich as Florian and Amy Farrington as Mallory. Sean did a good job of listing all of the wrestlers that are involved in the show. Just a quick nod, Pat sent me this note before. The girls in real life were trained by Chavo Guerrero Jr. Chavo Jr. was the trainer for the show, which is why they call it Chavo's Gym, which is a fun nod to his uncle Mondo Guerrero, who was the original trainer for the original GLOW. So some fun stuff there for people who watch the show. So overall, I'll take you some of my initial thoughts as the show began. We'll kick it back and forth here. I thought Allison Brie did a good job as Ruth, but she apes a lot of the characteristics in my mind of what's her face from Orange is the New Black. Jesus, what's the main character's name? Orange
Piper?
Is the New Black. Thank you. Piper, in that it takes a while. It took a while for me to really cheer for this character. She's so, between the overacting that she does and, you know, the terrible, you know, sleeping with the husband and just generally being not a great person, I found it a struggle to cheer for her until she sort of hits that midway point in the season where she really, really starts to try to better herself, and she sort of takes ownership of GLOW, and it isn't just about her and wanting to succeed as an actress. She sees the whole thing, and she's responsible for the whole thing, and she's really, really trying to elevate herself from where she started at the beginning of the season, which I liked. I thought that was a good arc for her. What did you think of Alison Brie?
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Jenji Kohan trope number one, or should I say just stage one of one particular character's set of tropes. In this case, it is that our series, at least initially, will feature an ensemble cast that surrounds a woman who has been thrown sideways by some poor life choice or another into an entirely different, fish-out-of-water, awkward life. This is how it starts. This is how it began with Nancy Botwin on Weeds. This is how it began with Piper Chapman on Orange is the New Black. And here we have Ruth Wilder. And it just kicks off just right off the bat with her. And the way this progresses is character makes shitty life choice. Character gets thrown off course into an unfamiliar new world and becomes a stranger in a strange land. Character continues to make dumbass life choices that makes her progressively harder and harder to root for at least a little while. And ultimately, everybody else around that character manages to stand out and become infinitely more interesting than the person we are theoretically supposed to be paying attention to. In fact, they also ultimately end up becoming more sympathetic / likable, just about to a person. And that is exactly what happens over the course of this show. It's good and it's bad because Jenji tends to do it so very well. But at the same time, it's that same problem that's like watching a Tim Burton movie. You could just about play bingo or a drinking game. Mark, remind me, I was kind of AWOL for a while. As TV party goes, have you gotten to season one of Weeds yet?
Nope, I was saving it for the second half of the year.
Ah, okay. I want you to keep in mind every single word that I just said when you get around to watching that show. And if you should decide to continue watching it on through completion, if so, God help you, because it really got shitty the last couple of years. I want you to watch it and then tell me on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being completely different and 10 being, again, you know, your average Tim Burton movie marathon. How much Weeds remind you of Orange is the New Black and remind you of GLOW?
All right, will do.
I guarantee you, you will see the parallels. But as far as the actual character goes, I like Alison Brie well enough. I've always liked her, and it's refreshing to see her really step a little bit further outside of the kind of adorkable, endearing roles that kind of first got her her biggest recognition on Community and as Princess Unikitty in the Lego Movie. This is, I don't know, it's a comedy, so I can't really liken it to her role in Mad Men. But, I mean, it certainly displays some range. So she's fun to watch. It's just that you realize really quickly, if you've seen those aforementioned other two shows, that this is a character you've seen before.
The character that she has the relationship with, and a lot of the show revolves around, played by Betty Gilpin, Debbie Egan. I thought she had a pretty solid storyline throughout this, though she tended to border on a bit samey in the sense of, you know, she gets pissed. They have that great scene where Marc Maron starts to imagine them wrestling, and he was like, "Oh, I pictured, you know, I was like, oh, I finally found my lead in this thing with Debbie Egan, you know," and he has them, you know, wrestling in his mind, and he was like, "I got it. I know exactly what I want now." And then just the next couple of episodes, it's a lot of the same, you know, I'll do it, but I don't like Ruth. I'll do it, but I don't like Ruth. Even at the end, there's a whole, before she finally gives in and says, okay, in order for me to look good, I've got to have a great heel, and the best heel on the bunch is Ruth. You know, it's still a lot of, I don't want to forgive anybody, and I'm just prickly, and I'm hurt, and she does. It's a lot of the same beat throughout the 10 episodes, and then even at that end there, you know, we're not there yet. Even after all of these successes, you would expect her to warm up somewhat, and I don't know. I thought she was a strong character, and I thought Betty Gilpin did a good job of playing her. There were times where I was a little frustrated with the writing. Where I was like I don't know. They're not giving her a lot of movement. It's a lot of the same thing over and over and over again. What did you think of Betty Gilpin as Debbie?
Pretty short and sweet. What I found interesting about it is the fact that the history of professional wrestling is littered with people from other walks of entertainment or athletics who kind of underestimated it and walked in and thought it was going to be an easy springboard to somebody else. I mean, for a good reference, look at the mid-90s landscape of WWE and their women's roster, and it's filled with, you know, models and B-movie actresses who kind of stumbled into it because they thought it would be, at the time, a fairly easy in to something like Playboy, or that, well, just because Dwayne Johnson did it and became a movie star, well, hot diggity dog, that means I can probably do it. Of course, it never ends up being that easy. But what really interested me about it was that she started off as that kind of character, as somebody who fell into it because, it's a role, it's something I can put on my resume, and it might get me noticed. But by the end of it, I felt like she had really transformed into somebody who came into wrestling from another walk of life and didn't have perhaps a childhood love for the business that a lot of people do when they first start wrestling. But kind of got bitten by the bug and started seriously throwing herself into wanting to excel at it and viewing it as a legitimate storytelling art form. Kind of, I guess I'm to throw men. Well, okay. In fact, no. I'll use women here. It kind of parallels sort of what I know of sort of Trish Stratus's arc when she first came into the business. She's said before that she got into modeling and in turn became involved with wrestling. I believe memory serves because while she was attending university and I believe was pre-med in
mm-hmm.
Canada, I believe there was a faculty strike, I think, and she kind of needed something else to make the ends meet. And so that was how she kind of stumbled backwards into first one and then the other. But she ultimately ended up really taking wrestling seriously and becoming a very committed performer and someone who wanted to refine her craft. So, yeah, and anybody who wants to agree is more than welcome to, but that's just the first name that brings to mind. So I thought it was a plenty interesting arc.
So let's talk a little bit about Mark Maron as Sam Sylvia. Here's another fairly unlikable character. His arc is, you know, he's sort of a Roger Corman B-movie director type, and he has a vision for what he wants this to be, and this is really just his way of getting another movie made. And eventually he is convinced to actually do a wrestling show and not the sort of B-movie schlock that he was trying to produce with women's wrestlers for some odd reason. But in general, you know, he's a chauvinist and he's another, just to name another director, he's, he's kind of Hitchcockian in that he regards the women more of moving scenery than he does actual people. But along the way, he's humanized. Skipping ahead, there's an episode where Ruth discovers she is pregnant, and even after being kind of a bag of shit for most of the series, he softens up here just enough to take care of Ruth and do her a solid and bring her to the abortion clinic and everything. And you see a different side of him. And then there's and I want you to comment on this as well, the subplot of him and his, and we'll find out, it turns out, who happens to be his daughter. Britt Baron is Justine Scab Biagi, who only got involved in this entire project because she wanted to find her dad, and she wanted to be with her dad, and she couldn't find the words to tell him that he was her dad, which leads to some awkward, almost kissing and not some other nonsense there. So go ahead. I know you're chomping at the bit here.
Well, the reason why I am is because when I first heard about the series, I wasn't excited about the notion that, oh, golly gosh, bejeebers, it's a show about GLOW. I must watch that. It was when I heard the initial casting of Allison Brie and Mark Maron, because, number one, I mean, I'm a huge, 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 like, beginning to end Community fan. And hey, what do you know? We do actually, in fact, get to see Annie's boobs. So that's a joke paid off in spades right there for you folks. But it's also the fact that I have for a long, long time not just been a fan, but very much an admirer of Mark Maron. For those of you who are not all that familiar with him, he is a veteran stand-up comic who has been around the block many times, currently hosts a phenomenal podcast called WTF with Mark Maron, great interview show. I strongly recommend you binge it at your earliest opportunity. But what I love about him here is the same reason why I loved him from his IFC show, Maron. And that's the fact that in everything that he does, even when he's acting, he's always playing almost always seemingly just a very slightly fictionalized version of himself. And he's often very, very, very candid, even in trying to laugh about it, about past struggles with addiction and mental health and a somewhat harrowing personal life. And it's not even a travails of fame kind of thing. It's just that's where he's coming from, and he's one of those comics who minds that for material and inspiration in a way that it's both easy to laugh at, but it's also easy to relate to him and feel really engaged with him. It's something that Louis C.K. also does phenomenally well. And his ability to do that, he may not be able to, you know, like Gary Oldman, how he disappears into a role so much so that you forget you're watching Gary Oldman. But Mark clearly has so much fuel and so much to draw from himself that any time he can bring that to a character, it is always, virtually without fail, worth watching. And I don't know if he's, for a fact, if he's ever had an experience with an illegitimate child tracking him down. But when I say you're constantly watching Mark in that role, I mean it in the most complimentary possible fashion. And it just so happens that who he is when he turns that volume up a little bit and kind of becomes a little more crass, a little more acerbic, but at the time, you know, a little more frustrated and jaded, he bounces off of everybody that he works with so very, very well. Because especially when it comes to Sam Sylvia's more racist tendencies, you get the impression that a lot of the gimmick ideas he comes up with, like, for example, take the Indian girl and we'll make her Beirut the Mad Bomber, and against her objections we'll just, you know, play her off as being Muslim, because fuck it, Iran's a big deal right now. They're hated, so hey, we got a great instant heel right there. We'll play off the awkward race relations and make Tammy Dawson the welfare queen. He takes that personality that's just kind of always on and manages to infuse that successfully with a character that he personally would probably be disgusted by, and yet it works. It really does. He's a pleasure to watch and kind of both hate and sympathize with as the show goes on. So he's without a doubt categorically a highlight.
I just want to take a brief moment to mention, I love the music in this show, from The Warrior to, I was watching this the entire time I was in chemo 2 weeks ago, and I almost jumped out of the fucking chair when Dare came on, and from the Transformers, the movie soundtrack, and it's in a great sequence, too. It's the montage where Ruth and Debbie are training together in the backyard of the Funkasaurus and Carlito, who I did not recognize at first. Yeah. So just just, you know, music can be an important part of a show, and it's almost its own character in this thing. I loved it. Almost every song that comes on throughout the series is fantastic and lends a lot of character to the show. With that said, we've got a little less than 15 minutes left, and I'm going to go ahead and throw it back to Sean. Sean, what do you want to talk about at this point? What's left unsaid? What elements of the show warrant discussion?
Really, to be perfectly honest with you, I think that it caught me off guard with the fact that, and this is something else Genji really has a way with, is, yeah, her shows are very much by the numbers in a way. It's a formula that works, but when you hear that she's the one behind it, she's, in a way, she's a little bit like Shonda Rhimes or Dick Wolf, in a way. She definitely has a style, a definite check-off-the-boxes kind of modus operandi when she brings a show together. But the thing is, her shows are often fairly accurate in terms of kind of getting to the heart of what she's really trying to say something about, whether it's weeds, making a commentary on some of the veiled personal struggles of seemingly cookie cutter sanitized suburbia, or if it's Orange is the New Black making a kind of having something to say about the prison industrial complex, as it often and very pointedly has. And this, okay, maybe it's nothing that's really quite that serious or that has quite that much gravitas yet, but when it comes to everything that it kind of says about 80s professional wrestling, folks, it's really pretty spot on. In terms of what you could expect if you were to go plunk down your $9.99 and get a WWE Network membership and go back and watch classic 80s World Wrestling Federation or anything from the territory days, like World Class Championship Wrestling or Mid-Atlantic. I mean, the WWF would be the showier aspect, but in terms of the simplicity of it, this is what wrestling was in those pre-Attitude Era days. There was a lot of, you know, mind the headlines for cheap heel heat. You know, all you had to do was look at the front page of a USA Today and, ba-dow, there you have it. You can pretty much pick a storyline from right there if you just cut and paste the characters. And, yes, sometimes it really narrowed them down to stereotypes. And you might have had people like who would say nowadays, like a Sam Sylvia type, who would say, well, no, back then we were making a commentary on what society was really like with the characters. Bull fucking shit. The hell you were. you needed to get somebody over. You needed kind of a quick fix, something that was a surefire, can't miss heel. And so you did basically what the territories did with, like, the Koloffs or Nikolai Volkov back in the day. Okay, Russians are a big deal. We'll make you a Russian. There's even something to be said about Ruth Wilder going and kind of trying to go all method with her character, kind of being akin to the stories of how Nikita Koloff, who, you know, is a born and bred Minnesotan. In fact, I seem to remember, I believe he went to high school with one of my friend's dads back when I was growing up. Where he genuinely adopted a Russian accent that he used all the time in and out of the ring, how he would even use it at family gatherings. He would not drop character. He went all Daniel Day-Lewis with it. So you have some people who do that, and you have some like the welfare queen who would take that character and just say, I may not like it, but you know what the hell? I'm gonna run with it. It's getting me over. I might as well. It's kind of weirdly endearing if you kind of grew up and came of age right around that time, but it is also absolutely 80s to the bone. So that gets a wholehearted for those of you who will get this joke. 5 stars. Joe Bob says, check it out.
Real quick, we have less than 10 minutes left. Excuse me. You know, we've talked about Orange is the New Black, all 5 seasons of it so far, and there were parts we liked of it, parts we didn't like. I have to say, some of the early Alison Brie stuff in the show is nigh unwatchable. And I'm not saying she's a bad actress. I'm saying the part that she's given, which she does an excellent job at, as this character Ruth. Ruth is unwatchable. She's so over the top. Just some of what she does in The Ring and on the outside of it is so over the top, and it's like, you know, cringeworthy. Just as an aside, there's a bit where Britannica starts to do the glow rap, and if there's nothing else that I remember of the original show, was that awful, awful, cringe-inducing, embarrassing rap that they would do at the beginning of the show.
You mean that was actually a thing?
Oh yeah, go on YouTube and watch the opening of Glow. They all used a rap. That makes me ashamed to be white. Even as a kid, I was like, "This is terrible." But those are the only things I can kind of. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the actual show. It's just, like I said, some of it, like I had to with Orange is the New Black season 5, where I had to just scan forward a little bit because I couldn't bear to watch someone be this dumb. Were there any elements, performances, or bits of the show that you didn't particularly enjoy?
If I'm to nitpick, I don't think that back then they were the small show like that was necessarily that big on, as you put it, the swerve angles.
Yeah,
you know, the constant on the fly improvised wacky storytelling. That's definitely somebody thinking that the way things are or the way things have always been. That's where
that was possibly Russo-esque. That ending.
Oh God. Oh, fuck yes. It's that part is utterly ridiculous and not in a good way. If you're to be really nitpicky, there are some portions where you watch some of the clips of other wrestlers, in particular when they drag Debbie to, I guess, what would be an indie show. And you look at it and go, okay, I'm seeing moves that weren't innovated until about a decade and a half or so after this. like for example, when you see Christopher Daniels bust out the best moonsault ever, for starters, if you haven't seen him fully in the face and realize that's who it is, when you see that, you know only one guy does a moonsault that way, and that's the Fallen Angel. So that's maybe a little bit hard to watch. It can be a little bit slow moving at times, as you said. It takes a while for Allison to really settle in to the character of Ruth, to the point where she actually becomes enjoyable to watch. But it's hard for me to have anything patently negative to say about it. Overall, it's solid. I mean, Netflix is really tightening the belt in terms of series renewals. I'm kind of amazed that Even Mystery Science Theater 3000 hasn't been given the official green light for a season 12, but, I mean, this seems like such a relatively inexpensive show to make, so I hope they get another season. But, yeah, again, I would say check it out, but just be warned that if you watched about the first half of Weeds and really liked it, and if you continue to dig Orange Is the New Black, you know what to expect. Don't expect this to be Genji being especially daring. At this point, she knows what works. She has settled into it, and you know the same way that Shonda Rhimes could throw pretty much damn near anything at ABC, and they'll probably give it a cushy primetime time slot. It works because you know what to expect. So
I think that's a great place to end our discussion. I love the show. I'm with Sean. I would recommend it. You know, it has slow parts, but overall, I thought 10 episodes was about right for this thing. And if you are any kind of fan of wrestling, damn Jim Cornette, it's a fine show. It's perfectly
yeah.
serviceable. Next week, Sean and I will be back. It's Spider-Man week. We've got all kinds of Spider-Man content for you. We've got on source material, The Gauntlet featuring the Vulture. There'll be a review of Spider-Man Homecoming. Metal Hammer of Doom will be reviewing Power Flow featuring featuring Sendog, who's formerly a member of Cypress Hill, members of Biohazard, members of Fear Factory. I love this album. It's fantastic. If you're into like the rap metal, you know, Prophets of Rage kind of a thing, go out and check out Power Flow on your Spotify account. We'll review it this Wednesday at 9 o'clock. And as I said, Sean and I will be doing our one of two on trials for the month of July. We'll be looking at Sony's Amazing Spider-Man 2, starring Jamie Foxx as Electro. I'm breaking the rules here a little bit, as I normally don't repeat content that we've done before, and we reviewed The Amazing Spider-Man 2 when it first came out, but that was mostly Pat and I yelling and screaming at one another and Robert Winfrey trying to step between us. So this is an opportunity for me to give a cohesive argument for why Spider-Man 2 was not the worst thing ever, and Sean will have his opportunity to give a coherent argument as to what's wrong with this movie and why Pat was right. God, Pat hated this thing. The following week, we've got all kinds of Planet of the Apes stuff going on. On source material, we'll be reviewing Tarzan on the Planet of the Apes. We'll be reviewing War for the Planet of the Apes on Tuesday on Damn You Hollywood. The Metal Hammer of Doom reviews the new Dying Fetus, Wrong One to Fuck With. And we are back for another on trial for the month of July. We got Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton version. I have the relatively easy job of prosecuting this piece of shit, and Sean's going to see how he can possibly step in front of this thing and defend it. I'm sure fun will be had by all. And that is it for on trials and stuff Sean and I are doing for the month of July. We have another one in August, but we'll, you know, when we get to it, we'll talk about it. Sean, you want to go ahead and do any plugs?
I don't really have anything. I kind of want to do some more creative, fun type stuff like this, but the last couple months have been a little bit rough. I haven't had much energy to fully devote to it, but hopefully, I'll come up with something in the fairly near future. But otherwise, this is the part where I always like to say thank you to everybody who listens to every one of our shows. If you like it, and tell a friend. Thank you. If you hate it and tell someone whose guts you hate, thank you as well. That still counts as a listen, still counts as a download. Feel free to hit us up anywhere you would like on the socials, Twitter, Facebook, etc. Let us know if you have an idea for a TV party you would like us to do. If you have an idea for Metal Hammer or On Trial, anything at all you would like, we're always open to suggestions, and you never know when we might hear something and go, say, them bars an idea. But no, you guys are the reasons why we do what we do, and it means the world to us that you take the time to either listen live or download. So I am going to say from my temporary, somewhat displaced fortress of Shaunitude, thank you everybody for listening. We love you all, and never dull your colors for someone else's a canvas.
All right, for Sean Comer, I am your mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm modified Mr. Mark Rattledge. Thank you for joining us. Be well, be safe, and be safe.